It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 513 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week we return to Zoop.gg for a very special YA book called The Nightcrawlers Volume 1. And I speak with Marco Lopez, one of the creators of the book, and it's described this way. From Ablaze Publishing comes a new all-ages supernatural adventure comic about a group of supernatural kid detectives by Eisner Award-winning writer Marco Lopez and artist on the rise Rachel Disler. It's for fans of Goosebumps, The Goonies, Monster Squad, Steven Spielberg films, and Don Bluth animated films. We talk about how the book came to be, who the characters are, and discuss the campaign in depth. I'm still working on my voice. I'm getting closer. Please be sure to listen to what Marco has to say, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Marco Lopez from a book called The Nightcrawlers, Volume 1, which is on Zoop.gg. And it's doing really well. Support's about halfway where it needs to be to get to have the project be successful. And it's going to, by my calculations, it's going to conclude on December 10th. So don't wait until then, before Marco. Let's go and get that done now.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you? So let me read real quickly the description that's on the Zoop.gg site. And I think your book is the first all ages. I think.
Yeah, we are. Had.
So good for that. Congrats on that.
Thanks.
Okay, I'll read the description real quick. From Ablaze Publishing comes a new all ages supernatural adventure comic about a group of supernatural kid detectives by Eisner Award-winning writer Marco Lopez and artist on the rise, Rachel Disler. For fans of Goosebumps, The Goonies, Monster Squad, Steven Spielberg films, and Don Bluth animated films, it's a 6x9 digest-sized hardcover graphic novel for ages 8 and up. So that sounds like really good. That you and I were talking before we started to record about how it's important to reach this age group that you're going to, 8 and up. I think that's a great, I'm glad you're doing that.
Yeah. I think one of the issues with comics is, you know, like I told, like when we were speaking earlier, like I was born in 1980. So, you know, I'm kind of in that spot of like I can relate to a lot of the older fans that are older than me, and I can understand some of the stuff with the younger fans. But I think at some point in comics started leaving the kids behind, and I think that's why manga filled that space, and then why now, you know, what's exploding and, you know, the publishing boom of, you know, the middle grade YA kids all ages, you know, the various different names they want to give for middle grade. But I think, you know, now that's exploding, because for the longest time, maybe since the late 90s, early 2000s, we kind of started leaving the kids behind. And then manga came in, did its thing, had their implosion. But then, like, sort of like kind of like how, you know, comics had the implosion in the 90s, manga had their implosion, I think it was in the mid 2000s, late 2000s. And then, you know, they kind of like, you know, got through that. And now it's back on the rise. But I think it's great to see these publishers embracing this young audience again, because like you were saying, these kids need books to read so that it makes them lifelong comic book fans. So when they get older, they'll go to stuff that's like, you know, PG-13, maybe they'll go to Marvel, DC, or some, like, you know, create our own comics that's more for, you know, older teenagers and such, or, you know, when they're 16 and things like that. And then that'll keep them buying comics. It'll keep the industry growing. They'll pass it on to their children and stuff like that, and they'll keep it expanding.
I agree with you 100%. I think that we make a mistake when we make comics for people who are 40 to 50 years of age, and we make books that go endlessly with the same story. And I'm thinking of a certain Marvel book that always does that. But I think that we need to do stories that will engage younger readers. And so I applaud what you're doing. I think it's so great that you're making a book like that.
Yeah. Like, my thing is, you know, I wanted to do something because, you know, again, growing up as a kid in the 80s, a lot of children's entertainment back then started becoming entertainment that wasn't just geared towards kids, but was probably similar to, like, early, you know, Walt Disney entertainment. Like, if you watch, you know, like Pinocchio, which I'm sure you've seen, you know, there's a lot of stuff in Pinocchio when you're a kid, it kind of goes over your head. But when you're an adult, you're just like, I cannot believe that's in Pinocchio, you know, the whole kid's drinking and, you know, the cigar stuff and all that. And as a kid, you just think it's funny stuff. But, you know, then in the 80s and 90s, you know, more so in the 90s, you started seeing not only in kids' entertainment, but in comic books was very much all ages. Like, if you could be 8 or 80 reading X-Men. And now I feel it's kind of like you can only be maybe an older teenager or an adult reading X-Men. Like, I don't know if kids get any kick out of reading X-Men, you know, like they did, like, I did when I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, my biggest problem with X-Men is you have to know 40 years of continuity in order to understand all the stuff that's going on. And I don't know 40 years of continuity. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Like, kids. And the problem with that is, like, if I'm a kid, you know, like when I was a kid in the late 80s, early 90s, it was like, the biggest competition was maybe like VHS and Nintendo. And it was like, you're talking rudimentary graphics. So of course you'll go back and, you know, find back issues and try to catch up and read, you know, bios on trading cards and all that stuff, you know, like that sort of era, you kind of had a sweet spot of it was easier to, like, you know, figure out what was going on in comics. But nowadays when you're like competing against streaming and video games that are literally like you're living the comic book and movies that are doing everything, you know, on screen that, you know, comic books used to only do, it's kind of hard to tell kids who are reading manga now, which, like, if you're reading, you know, one of the most popular mangas ever, like One Piece or My Hero Academia, it's like they only have to read one book. You're asking kids to, like, oh, what about this X-Men book and that X-Men book and that X-Men book? And it's just like, no kid wants to sit there and spend $4 on, like, you know, a 20-page comic when they can go get a manga that's like 168, 180 pages for like $10, you know?
That's true. I think you're right. Because it's a good thing. Now, of course, I'm interested. It's called The Nightcrawlers, your book is. And of course, where I grew up, a nightcrawler was a worm. You're going to go fishing, you would go and catch them at night. But what does nightcrawlers mean in the universe of your book?
And this, it's, you know, for this, it was when I was creating this, I wanted something. Because, you know, I got the name from, you know, the Nightcrawlers, the worms and all that. But I wanted it to be something that would sound like something that kids would create. Like, you know, kids name stuff, you know, like my, you know, fiance's daughter, she named, you know, the dog that we have, she called him Puppy. Like, his name is Puppy, you know? Like, kids pick the most funniest or things that they think logically make sense, you know? But you as an adult, you're kind of like, you know, why would you call him Puppy? Why don't you give him a name like John or, you know, or something else? But for her, it was like, he's called Puppy. And, you know, kids, I could see, you know, I had this idea that, you know, kids would, you know, pick something because they think it's cool and creepy. And in this story, these kids name this for their group because, you know, they think it's something that's, you know, represents, you know, them, the idea that, you know, they're dealing with, you know, things that go bump in the night and creatures and night crawlers, you know, sounds like mysterious and cool. And it's like, who are you going to call for help? Almost, you know, in a Ghostbusters way. But what they're going to find out in the story is that they're not the first night crawlers. Like, there's a whole mystery in there, like a subplot that, you know, because these kids think that they're the first ones creating this whole group because, you know, the kids in this book, they're survivors, you know, they live in an orphanage and they're survivors of monster attacks, you know, like, you know, basically werewolves I try to go more into what's your typical, a lot of people, when they do supernaturals, like werewolves, vampires, etc. So I try to go more into, like, if we're doing werewolves, it's more like skinwalkers,
you know, like we're doing stuff like from, you know, Irish, you know, fairy tales and urban legends, the Morrigan and things like that, and fairies and stuff like that. So, you know, they're survivors of, like, if you watch a horror movie, and horror movies and always like the slashers, it's always, you always have the survivor girl. And I asked myself one day, what if like all the people that survived like either a slasher or a monster, you know, what if they were kids that ended up being orphans, you know, their families were gone, they're orphans. And what if they, you know, end up in this orphanage and they decide to make sure that, you know, come together to make sure that what happened to them doesn't happen to any other kids. And it's such an overly ambitious thing for little kids to do, but that's what kids tend to do. They try to like do things that are bigger than them, you know? And the whole, you know, sorry for the long-winded response, but the whole idea is they think they came up with the name, the Nightcrawlers, but where you find out in the subplot is that they've kind of been led towards that path of sort of like resurrecting this group that's been around or was at one point around for decades, this secret group of kids that worked with adults that were called the Nightcrawlers. And that's going to, we're going to, you know, if there's a sequel and stuff, it's going to delve more into that history and background and things like that.
Okay, that sounds good. So how many kids are in the group?
There are five. It's Calvin, Mika, Bruno, Alana. I believe her name is Alana. I forget. And then Francesca. So it's five kids, and they all come from different backgrounds, different ethnicities. You know, there's, I believe, three girls and two boys. Calvin and Bruno are the two boys. And then there's Mika. She's the oldest one. Then there's Alana. She's the youngest one. And then there's Francesca. And Francesca, when the story opens, you can see on the preview pages in Zoop, you get sort of a peek into the end of her tragic story that led her to the orphanage. And you sort of get a peek of what she dealt with. That led to the end of her family and like destruction of her neighborhood. Yeah. So like, you know, Francesca is basically the inventor, the gadget one of the group. And then, you know, Calvin's sort of like the Batman, you know, the Bruce Wayne, he's the sort of like the detective, the serious, he keeps this, you know, notebook. He's always one step ahead. You know, Mika's she's the one who's like, she believes she's the group leader, and she's always butting heads with Calvin. And she's always like pushes the kids to come together and do this and create this group. And then you have Bruno. He's sort of like, you know, the stocky, the muscle of the group, I guess you could say. And then Alana, she's the youngest. She's the graphic designer of the group. She's the artist of the group. You know, and they have this treehouse that's like the most exaggerated treehouse. Cause I'm like, if I'm going to do a treehouse, you know, cause they're at this grand orphanage that's run by this guy who's a Christopher Lee type, who used to be an actor. He's like in his 80s or 90s. And he used to be an actor back in the day in like Hammer type horror films. And, you know, so he runs this orphanage, and what you'll find out, and it's not a mystery, you know, something that's like a twist in the book, but you'll find out is that he, you know, used to be monster hunter by day, actor in, you know, horror films in the 60s and 70s, all that by monster hunter by night, sorry, actor by day, you know? And it's my love of like Hammer films and Christopher Lee and, you know, Vincent Price and all those things that made me create that character and do that kind of setup. And you can see splashes of X-Men inspiration, you know, older guy who's, you know, has this, you know, not in this case, it's an orphanage, but, you know, an X-Men, Professor X has the school and these kids are brought together, and you'll see like things. Cause as a kid, I grew up as a heavy like X-Men fan.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. So this, how many pages are in this hardcover, a 6x9?
It's going to be, I think it's going to be about 100 pages.
Wow.
I think it's going to be about that. It's I think we're going for anywhere from like 88 to 100 pages. So still working out certain details on it, on the story-wise, you know, towards the end as to how, you know, I want to, you know, stick the landing. And the story is a done in one, so it's, you know, beginning, middle, and end, but it leaves enough open for that if it does well for a sequel. And it kind of, you know, the story, like I said, is beginning and the end, but there's an end bit, I guess you could say, like, I think it's, you know, the prologue, I believe it's called, where there's like, there's a bit where it's kind of like, here's your cliffhanger moment in like classic, you know, comic book nature, you know, a lot of like 70s, you know, comic books, you know, stuff like that, where you'd have like these cliffhanger, how comic books used to have, where you'd have like a whole story and then you kind of have like a cliffhanger movie moment. And it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, come back next issue to read, you know, what's going to happen. And I kind of like mm-hmm. built that, you know, classic moment into this towards the end.
Great. It sounds like good. Is it black and white or is it color?
Color. You'll see the color pages on there, and then you also see the black and white pages just because we're offering the first four original pages for purchase. But it's mm-hmm. a full color book. And great. It's got great colors that remind me of, like, you know, 80s, like, you know, Don Bluth films.
Yeah, because the cover looks very much like that. There's a lot of great color, and the artwork looks really engaging and stuff. It looks like are those wolves, or are they? There's a dragon, or behind?
They're the skinwalkers that are part of the story, and I wanted to do something because, you know, wolves in a lot of, like, you know, stories, it's either brown, maybe white, maybe, you know, they're usually dark, muted colors. And I wanted to go, if we're going to do skinwalker take on werewolves, you know, more like, you know, Native American, Mexican, you know, mythology, I wanted to, you know, also make them a little more colorful, a little more different. So they're very, like, their bodies are more elongated, their hands are more longer. You know, I wanted to, like, play with the dynamic, make it, you know, a little more creepier, a little more freakier, and then, you know, mess with the colors too. And, like, you know, why do they have to be such, you know, dark muted colors? Let's, you know, make them purplish. Let's play around with the colors, because it's like, why not? You know what I mean? We're all dealing with stuff that's very mythological. So why not in this children's, you know, this all ages book, you know, go for a little more crazier color concepts.
Great, great. Sounds really good. The reason I asked that is because if you look on the Zoop page, there are the original artwork, which is for sale on some of the pages, and there's you can see it's in black and white, and of course that's pre-colors, I think, and it really looks kind of cool. I really like that. I wouldn't even mind it in black and white, to be honest with you.
Oh yeah, I love, like, you know, growing up reading, you know, a lot of the indie comics in the 80s and the early 90s, I love black and white comics. Black and white comics are one of my favorite things, especially, you know, manga. I think there's just so, I think, like, I love color, and there's some amazing colors out there, and, you know, and colors do such an amazing job. But I always think when you look at, especially older comics, I always feel there's something lost in the translation from black and white to color. I think sometimes black and white is just better for certain mediums like horror. And I think some stories just pop more in black and white.
I think you're right, especially horror. I think it's just great that way. Now, something that's really interesting to me, and of course, there's one of the I already have signed up for you and supported you, and I went in for the paper edition, the hardcover graphic novel, and there's also a digital copy, and you can get a copy that's signed and personalized. Is that by you, or is that by both you and the artist?
That's, if I'm not mistaken, that's going to be by both me and Rachel. I don't have the sign up, but I believe I'm like 99% sure that's by both me and Rachel. And most likely it's going to be, is they're going to have to, like, ship the books to me and then sign. They'll probably end up doing, like, book plates, where I forgot what the exact nature is. Cause when we were talking about that, I don't remember if it was just, they were going to ship the books and, you know, to me, sign personalized and ship them to Rachel, she'll sign personalized, or if it would be like a book plate that you put on the book. I have to find out about that because I do not remember the exact details, but they definitely will be signed and personalized by me and her.
Great, great. So there's another thing that I always love. I actually once signed up for it when it was in a price range I could afford. Unfortunately, you're asking for $200, but you get drawn into the comic. And you've actually got one out of three have been claimed. So that's great. And is this actually going to be in the first volume they're going to be drawn in?
Yep. It'll be, yeah. Okay, it'll be in that first volume.
Because some people wait until the second volume.
Oh, no. Yeah, the first one. Like, I wouldn't want to do that to anybody. Be like, yeah, we'll draw you, you know, into the second one. No, there's still plenty of time to you know, have people drawn into the book, because I believe it's what you get drawn into the background, and we'll make sure that it's like a very cool, fun scene that they're drawn into. You know, it's kind of like when you're an extra. Like I used to do, like when I lived in Texas, extra work on Friday Night Lights. So it's always cool when you see yourself on the screen. And I remember I did one extra work for like a big
a B movie that was on Sci-Fi Channel. I think it was called like Big Ass Spider. And every time you watch that movie or the trailers, I see myself all over it. I'm like, oh, there I am. There I am.
Yeah, I was in one that was a show or a book about a Moby Dick who was like an undead Moby Dick. And I got drawn in as one of the sailors on the ship that was chasing him, which was fun.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it was cool. I really liked that. So you're selling, looks like you're selling looks like 4 or 5 pages from the book. Looks like it's up for grabs. Some pages 1 through 5, looks like. Or 1 through 4. And then there's an original art of the treehouse schematics. So
That's pretty. Rachel. No, go. Sorry.
That's okay. The price is pretty reasonable, too. $250 for a full page. That's really good.
Yeah.
That's a pretty reasonable price.
Rachel, she did some beautiful, like, if you look at those pages, they're gorgeous. And that's something that Rachel agreed on with, you know, Blaze and Zoop. And it is, you know, really reasonable. And that schematic, because we're doing, I think it's an add-on tier or a pledge tier. That's the, you can get a poster of that schematic. Cause I thought, you know, the treehouse plays such a big part with these kids. And it's such like it's basically the treehouse I wish I had as a kid. You know, any kid probably wishes they had. So I was like, well, you know, I was like, Rachel, let's make that the treehouse. And I was like, wouldn't it be cool to have like a schematic poster type thing, you know, that illustrates what's really in this treehouse. And she did that gorgeous drawing that you see there. It's going to be in color for the poster. And she's worked, I think she's almost done with the colors, and this, we're going to update and show that. But then you can get the original art of that as well.
Very cool. Very cool. Now I'm just curious as to when it comes to the various characters and to the, and there's like a little creatures that you can see, like they got wings, looks like butterfly type, maybe imps or something like that. How closely did you work with Rachel as far as getting the look of the characters and the different creatures?
I always like to like not be so imposing, because I know there are some writers in comics that feel like, you know, they should like, you know, basically give very, very, very detailed. I like to just kind of do a vision board type thing where I kind of like, I'll basically write down my idea of like what I think it should look like. And then I'll include like images that are kind of like close to what's in my head. And then I always say to Rachel, you know, I'll say, hey, you know, feel free to, you know, add your own thoughts, embellish, you know, bring you to the design. Just don't be like, oh, okay, well, this is what he wants, so I'm going to do. I mean, we're creative partners on this. So I'm like, you know, always make it yours as well. And then, you know, she'll basically say like, hey, so, you know, here's some different designs, or here's this design, you know, what do you think? And I was also thinking of doing this and that. And I'll be like, oh, cool, you know, and we'll do a little back and forth, and then we'll get to something that we both agree on. And we're like, that's it. And then we'll move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm. What are those little things? Because you can see them on the color pages on the Zoo page. They look like little nymphs or something. They got, looks like butterfly wings. What are they?
They're supposed to be like, you know, like fairies, like, you know, these weird fairies, like, you know, Morrigan, which is part of the whole, like, you know, Oberon elves, you know, the very like Irish, Scottish, you know, English, you know, mythology and all that of fairies and elves and, you know, woodland creatures, you know. So we're playing like a little fast and loose with that whole, you know, folklore and things like that. And, you know, so we're kind of like doing our own take on that. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, I want to do with this series is take some things that are familiar and then things that are not so familiar. And then let's do our own, like, you know, wacky, crazy, you know, in some ways over the top, but in some ways, like, just very physically different. Let's not give the same. If we're doing fairies or, you know, fairy-like creatures, let's not always do the same as you always see them everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Because they look very different, I have to say.
Yeah. That's, you know, that's what I love that Rachel, you know, brings to that, you know, when we're discussing these designs. Is, you know, because I'm always like, well, let's not do something like, you know, like when you mentioned the werewolves, I'm like, you know, if we're going to do skinwalkers and we're doing more of the skinwalker taking these, you know, let's mess with the colors. Let's go bright colors. Let's make the body of the werewolf very elongated and the claws very long and heavy, you know, stuff like that. Like, always give it something different. Because if you're going to do something familiar, try to make it unfamiliar looking or very creepy or odd. You know, don't always go for the same thing, because then you're just, you know, repeating what someone's already done before.
Right, right. You know, I just got a look at the fort. Wow, that's a big place they've got.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Yeah. That's up in a tree. Wow, that's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, there's going to be a whole thing about the tree that, you know, we won't get into in the first volume. If the first volume is a success, we'll get into it in the probably the second or third volume. The idea of this, you know, trees been there since, you know, probably about the late, and there's a whole thing that goes into the history of, you know, the kids that became the first night crawlers in World War I and where the tree comes from. And it's sort of like a very, I don't want to say supernatural, but there's a very historical, you know, thing, maybe a little magical, you know, thing with the tree, you know. So there's a very, you know, history, you know, to that, you know, what the tree represents and why it's there and why it's there at the orphanage and stuff like that. So it's got its own story there. And, you know, and I wanted to be like, let's go crazy. Let's go over the top. You know, as a kid, when you always think of a treehouse where you're always trying to build a fort or do something with friends, you're always trying to, you know, wish you could match what's in your imagination as a child. And you generally never come close. But as you're playing with your friends, it's always just fun and you think it comes close enough. And I was like, what if these kids in this orphanage, you know, that's run by this guy who's, you know, has done so many movies that he's well off. What if they actually have the dream, you know, treehouse that, you know, every kid wishes they could have, that you would see that's almost in its wake. So like something out of an Ewok village, you know? So I was like, let's just go crazy with it. And she was like, all right, right on. And she did an amazing job.
Because there's like a whole bunch of parts to it. There's an art room, there's a meeting room, and there's obviously a place with a hammock in it. Then there's a second building, and there's storage and a workshop. And so they've got all kinds of a safety net, I guess, in case they need to jump out. There's a net that catches them and stuff like that. That's quite amazing. I've never seen a treehouse like that. That's pretty great.
Yeah, yeah. Like I wanted to, you know, these kids are going to be like these kid detectives dealing with the supernatural. And, you know, I wanted to be like, why not have, you know, this base, this, you know, this place that's, you know, the kids' version of the, you know, the Hall of Justice, or the kids, you know, the Avengers, like the Fantastic Four building, or the Avengers Tower and things like that. Like, you know, basically something that's their version of that. And the idea is we'll find out, you know, more about the treehouse, and, you know, that, you know, they didn't have it, you know, built for them. But the idea is that it was something that was kind of similar in size, but rickety, as we'll find out, you know, down the line. And then, you know, they had, you know, their caretaker, William, you know, basically, you know, they begged him to rebuild it. And, you know, that's basically future volume stuff. And they decide when it gets rebuilt, when, you know, they, you know, go back, when they become the Nightcrawlers, the idea is, you know, we're going to make this our base. And so they decide to, you know, fit it out. And, you know, but with the idea of like, oh, we're just, you know, having fun in art room and all this stuff, without, you know, letting on to the adults, you know, Mary, who's, you know, William's daughter, who basically, you know, helps take care of the kids. And she's a psychologist, and, you know, she's helping these kids deal with this trauma and all that they've been through. And, you know, and these kids are basically, they think they're secretly, you know, creating this group of, you know, monster hunting kid detectives, and that, you know, that they're doing something like very Batman-like, even though, you know, Batman doesn't exist in the world, but, you know, they think they're getting away with something cool. And then they realize, like, you know, they'll find out, like, you know, you weren't the first ones doing this. And, you know, we're kind of like not oblivious to what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. It really looks great. Gosh, all kinds of stuff like that. Now, this is for volume one. Do you know how many volumes you've got in mind?
If everything goes well with volume one, I have roughly laid out 6 volumes. That's not to say volume 6 would be the last one. That's just in my head right now, how it roughly plays out. There's also an idea of doing prequels that would be set during World War II, and then after World War II, that basically deals with the history of the Nightcrawlers and, you know, how they came to be and, you know, things like that. You know, so it would, you know, stuff that goes into the past and things, there's stuff that goes into like William's, you know, past and stuff like that as a monster, you know, Hunter, you know, and all that. So there's idea, you know, if this were to become a big thing, then it's like, oh, you know, we could go up to volume 6 or more, and we could do prequel volumes, you know, historical supernatural fiction, you know, stuff like that. So I have this sweeping idea of like, oh, if this were to ever become something big and popular, then there's plenty to, you know, expand upon here. And, you know, hopefully that's something that happens.
Cool. Now, the question I've got too is, where does this all take place? Is this in America?
Yes, it's in America. I think it's basically, if I'm not mistaken, I forget where I said it because right now everything's like, I'm like connecting to my phone to talk to you. Like basically I connect my laptop to my phone's internet. Okay. We don't have internet in the house yet, so I'm not able to pull up my notes. But the idea is I set it in a fictional town because I love the idea of DC Comics where you had like Gotham and Metropolis and, you know, all of that. And I love the idea of like fictional, you know, towns and cities because you can mess around. Like, you know, you have the, you know, the very Art Deco nature of, you know, Gotham City, you know, the Gothic, you know, and all that. And Metropolis is the very shiny, you know, it's a very like, you know, the future is envisioned in the 1950s World Fair, you know, stuff like that. So I wanted to go with this, you know, small town, you know, that's sort of like, you know, Kid Flash, you know, where basically, you know, I think Kid Flash is from like Blue Valley, Nebraska, if I'm not mistaken. I think Wally West was originally from. And, you know, so it's basically in a fictionalized town in America. But, you know, their caretaker is from Europe. He's from England. And he retired in America and he bought this old, like gigantic, like, I wouldn't say mansion, but, you know, really big house with all this land. And, you know, and basically it's where he decided to retire and, you know, basically where he has all his, you know, memorabilia and history as an actor and all that. And it's where basically until he got to a certain point was basically, you know, secretly fighting, you know, still fighting the good fight against monsters.
Wow. Okay, very good. Now, I always like to ask the creator, and you're part of the team, but are the kids and the characters, any of them based on anybody that you know, or are they kind of all figments of you guys' imagination?
A little of both. You know, Bruno's a little me in that way, in that, you know, he's a headstrong, you know, thinks he's always right, you know, kid, you know, for me growing up, he's sort of like a chubby, stocky kid. You know, that, you know, Alana, you know, his sister, I base, you know, a little on my sister when she was younger. You know, the Mary character, that's William's daughter, that basically is the, you know, the psychologist and helps take care of the kids. You know, she's named after my sister. And at one point my sister was going to do psychology with kids. You know, so a little here and there is based on, you know, people I grew up with, you know, friends that I have. And I was like, oh, and I always ask them, like, hey, is it cool? And they're like, yeah, yeah. And then a lot of the stuff is just, you know, kids, you know, growing up, you know, you notice kids when you're, you know, kids of your friends and things you notice of like that of, you know, when you're out and about and you see people with their kids and things you pick up about that. And then it's a lot of the stuff also is just, you know, made up, you know, the idea of like, you know, if you were a kid in this situation, what would you be like, or how would you turn out?
Mm-hmm. What's interesting too, is that this is kind of that age group that comics really loves. You know, a lot of times they're older teens, but these are kind of, are they in the age group or about 8 and above? Is that where the kids are mostly?
They're, if I'm not mistaken, Alana, I believe is 10. She's the youngest, and everybody else is 11, except for I think Mika is like 11 and a half or 12. And that plays into an important part of the story, because there's going to be this whole idea of that, like, you know, and it's a whole mystery. I don't want to give away too much, but this idea that there's a reason why, and it's not an original idea. It's been, I'm playing around with my own version of it. But there's always that idea that you always see in you've seen from time to time in movies about supernatural creatures and monsters, about how kids tend to see them. And then when you become an adult, you kind of tend to not believe or forget that monsters exist, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm playing around with that idea. And then the idea of like, well, when you get older, if you forget that monsters exist, how does William and, you know, their caretaker know that monsters? And that's a whole, you know, mystery there of like how he's able to you know, remember the monsters and that monsters are real and stuff like that. You know, so it's the whole thing that I'm playing with in that story with the Nightcrawlers.
Very good. It's really, really cool. Now, one of the things you did, one of the benefits I like is that there's a $50 level where you get a retailer and library bundle, 5 copies for $50, and you can go into libraries so people can check them out or sell them at stores and stuff like that. I really think that's a great way to help get them on the shelves in either place. So I wanted to tell you, I think that is a great decision you guys made to do that.
Oh yeah, I love libraries is one of the ways that I found my love of comic books, but also continued reading comic books. I remember when I was a kid in the 80s, I think it was late 80s or maybe early 90s, we used to go to this library in Florida, you know, and they would have the spinner rack with the comics, and you could check out comic books from the spinner rack. And I think you could check them out for a few days. I forget how long back then you could check out stuff from libraries. And then you would return them. And I remember getting Marv Wolfman, George Perez, Teen Titans books on that spinner rack. And that was and I thought that was crazy awesome when I was a kid going to the library and they have comic books you can check out. And the equivalent nowadays is, these kids and YA, graphic novels, and you can get Marvel and DC stuff, and you get manga and libraries. And I just think libraries are, to me, are the, so much funding should be going to libraries more than they already get. And I think, libraries are such a treasured institution. And, a lot of people I know in this day and age think, oh, well, streaming and rental and Kindle, it's why do you need libraries? And I'm because not everybody wants Kindle. Not everybody has a Kindle or laptops or can afford all that. And I just think there's something amazing and classic about libraries. And one of the libraries that's next to my parents, where, they live, I love, is they have a section in the library that's outside of it. That's this room where they take all the books, that they have, let's say if they bought 10 copies of a book, years ago, but now they're okay, we're only going to keep 2 or 3 for the library because no one's hardly checking them out. They'll take the 7 and they'll put them in this room for sale. And they have this little sign that says, if you get the hardcovers, it costs this much each. If you get the soft covers, it costs this much each. Just put the money in the box or a check. We're going by the honor system. And I'll go there and I'll just raid the shelves and then put money in the box and walk out the door with a stack full of books.
Wow. Well, I know there's some people who for hospitals with kids that are in hospitals, they're donating comics so that hospitals can give them to the kids who are patients, which I think is a great thing too.
Yeah. I think for me, the comic book, cause there's so much in the industry where they try to, think that, with comic books, there's a new way to tell stories of comic books, digital or with, motion comics or with, a new way digitally to tell stories. And I think comics is a perfect medium. It's a perfect design. There's nothing you really need. There's nothing you really can perfect in comic books, but to tell better stories. I think it's the perfect amalgamation of novels and, cinema, cause it's static pictures. But comic books have a way in which, if they're done right, it feels like it's a moving, when you're reading it, it feels like it's moving. When you think back of the stories, you don't think in static images of the comic book that you read. You think of it was moving in motion. And that's why what I think is so perfect about the medium.
Right. I think that's one of the great things about comics is our brain fills in the gaps from one panel to the other.
Yep.
It's great. Now, I've got a question for you. Because I noticed in the description, and I read it, that you have won an Eisner Award. What did you win the Eisner Award for?
I won it. I was one of 5 editors. I created this anthology called Puerto Rico Strong that came out from Lion Forge Comics. And this was in 2018 it came out. So basically in 2017 what happened was, there's the 2 hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico. And right before the second one hit Puerto Rico, I hit up a friend. I hit up my friend Derek, and I said, "Hey, we should do something to help Puerto Rico because they're about to get hit by the second, hurricane. There's got to be something we can do." And I was like, "The only thing I know how to do is comics." So like maybe we can create an anthology where the proceeds can go to help, you know, the people in Puerto Rico. And he's like, let's do it. I hit up Desiree, who at the time was working on Lionforge's Catalyst Prime line as an assistant editor. And she was like, I'm in. And then Neil brought in, Derek brought in Neil, who's a good friend of ours. And then, you know, I hit up, because at the time I had done some work from like 2015 to 2016 for Lionforge Comics. And so I hit up one of the, you know, founders there and owners, Carl Reed. And I told him about the project and he's like, yeah, that's something we'd be interested in and getting involved with. And then Desiree during the meeting, you know, she brought it up again and they were all in. And then they brought in Hazel Newlevant as an editor to work with us. And we were off to the races. Like we put, it was a 208 page book that we put together in, I think it was 4 months, maybe 3.5 months. Like basically when we were talking about it back in maybe like late September, early October, something like around there, started reaching out to initial, you know, talent, you know, artists, you know, writers, you know, names in the business. And, you know, a bunch of them were like, yeah, you know, if you're going to do this, you know, I want to be in. And then, Desiree had a list of all these, you know, different Puerto Rican Hispanic, creators that she was like, you know, she's been cataloging and we used that to reach out. And, you know, a lot of people were just, you know, they wanted to be involved. They wanted to do this. They thought it was a great cause. And it was one of the craziest times of my life. Of, you know, reaching out to talent, putting together a book, like to do such a huge, massive thing in like 3.5-4 months. And then it got released in the spring of 2018. It sold through 10,000 copies, went to a second printing. Lionforge matched the proceeds that went towards, you know, charity. I forgot which charity group they worked with because this was like 3 years ago. And then, you know, I got nominated for an Eisner and I never thought that was going to happen. I did the book just, you know, cause I'm like, I was born in Puerto Rico. I'm from there. My family's from there. And I just wanted to do something good using a medium I loved. But everyone was telling me like, oh, you're probably going to get nominated for an Eisner. I was like, no, we're not. And then it happened. And I was like, oh, well, that's cool. But I was like, we're not going to win, but it's cool that we got nominated. Like this is amazing. I love comic books to get nominated for such a coveted award for stuff, you know, that's named after one of the greatest creators in this industry who created the spirit. You know, I love pulp characters. And then when we won it, it was like, wait, what? It was like a very surreal moment because it was me, Derek, and Neil, and we were talking in our chat group that we have, and we were watching the updates on Twitter. You know, I forgot which website, I think it was Fanbase Press was doing the updates from the Eisner show. And then it got to the anthology and, you know, they were, you know, et cetera, you know, going through the whole what's being said. And then it said, the winner is, and it came up Puerto Rico Strong. And it was just like, it was like time slow, the whole idea where they say like time slows down, you know, mm-hmm. It felt just like that. And mm-hmm. It was like, oh my God, we won. And it was the most crazy, surreal moment of my life to win what's one of the most prestigious awards in this industry. You know, and it felt like such a culmination of not only as a fan, but of doing this good thing that was just for the purpose of, you know, doing something good for, you know, the island that I came from. And it's been an amazing ride because that book has been, you know, it's been in libraries, it's been in schools, it's used as a teaching tool. Because one of the things we set out to do with that book was not only to do, you know, these stories of people in Puerto Rico and, you know, hurricanes and stuff like that. But we also touched on social issues, historical stuff. And it's been a book that's been recommended by professors and studies at colleges, that's been used in high schools and junior high and stuff like that. And it's gone on to having a life of its own.
Oh, it's great. Great. Well, congratulations on that. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
I hope this book does something similar for you, the Nightcrawlers. I think it looks like a great book. I think the art and the concept, I was reading a little bit of the concept, which kind of got me in it. And it says in the story that Nightcrawlers take on their first case when a friend from school believes werewolves replaced his parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, it was, I just like this idea of, for me, it was this idea of like, if you think something's oddly going on with your parents, that they're acting differently, and you see these creatures in your, like you catch a glimpse, like, you know, when you're supposed to be late at night sleeping and your parents tell you like, oh, when you're, at least for me, like I notice kids nowadays tend to go sleep later.
But for me as a kid around that age, it was like I had to be in bed like at 8:30, you know? But there's sometimes when you get up in at night and, you know, maybe like within 2 hours of sleeping and your parents are up watching TV and you're like, oh, what are, you know, you're as a kid, you're like, oh, why aren't they asleep? You know, and you're wondering like what cool things your parents are doing. It's kind of like that idea. And he sees these creatures, you know, turn back into his parents. So as a kid, you're not thinking like those are my parents. You're thinking these are things that replace my parents, you know? And that's what, you know, kicks off this whole adventure that, you know, the Nightcrawlers end up going on.
Okay, well, this is great. Well, I wish you much success. Again, it looks like it's going to be December 10. So you want to make sure that you don't wait until then. Do it as soon as you can so that Marco doesn't have to keep refreshing the screen to see if somebody else has backed it. We want to get past that. The goal is $6,000, and you have to get that by December 10. So all I can say is it looks like a great book, and I can't wait to read it. I think it's going to be great fun. I've already signed up to get one, like I said, and I encourage you to do likewise. So, Marco, I hope that you guys have very successful, and we get all the volumes you want for this, and we get this. I'd love to see this on Target someday. That'd be great.
Oh, that would be awesome. I'd love it, too. Thank you so much.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.